start. I'll say a couple minutes worth of semi-irrelevant things so that in case the tape recorder isn't working, nothing will be missed. I've been here for an hour and a half listening to Wits, and the tape recorder wasn't on, and now I'm to start, and the tape recorder is here, and this puts tremendous pressure on you because you get the feeling that you have to say something, and to top the Wits is itself quite a problem. But as I was listening, I kept thinking many of you heard them. There's one problem in communication that you have with the Wits when you discuss models and we're discussing children. Before we knew the Witt children, we've known Elmer and Ginny for many years, but somehow we never crossed the generation gap. And we expected to find a very obnoxious breed of youth, because you usually assume the children of people who are experts in a certain field are turning out just the opposite. Psychiatrists' children are usually the most shook up, and preachers' children are the most ornery, and all the rest. So family life people should have hopeless children. We've gotten to know them, however, and the only theory that Elsa and I have finally come up with is that they were born without original sin. So Elmer and Ginny are friends and all that, but I don't think they quite explain the way the kids are turning out. So don't try to follow and think it'll work on those grounds. You all should have a pink or a blue. The men get pink and the girls get blue, or vice versa. This will be roughly what I like to work on with you this week. I notice on the week's schedule, which is at least as complex as Eisenhower's chart the day before D-Day or the Apollo 11 mission control chart. I haven't made it all out yet. All kinds of colorful things. Dr. Bainton is here. I noticed an exciting thing next Sunday morning at 9. It said Roland Bainton meeting. If you look a long time, you'll see that the S of Matins blends into a line and makes it meeting. And at 4 o'clock every day, it's Bainton at the river. When I heard him last night talk about permanence and change and thinking that's what I was going to be on this week, I decided to call my sessions this week Marty Up the Creek. I've learned not to come into a place like Holden and assume that you bring a load to it that you have to unload. I've much more preferred to live into a place and learn its style and relate to it, because I think that while the outsider and the newcomer should always have some new infusion, he should do it as a part of the community. So when Carol Hinderly this morning at breakfast, for the early bird breakfast, mentioned that we were here because we happen to be vacationing Northwest anyhow, it sounds as if we're making Holden a kind of a pit stop. Which isn't exactly true. It's just that our family charts 5-6 years ahead what direction we want to go. And Northwest was programmed for about 3 years hence when he first wrote, and so he said that would be the year that would be fun to be at Holden. So we're glad to be here. Though we had no idea at that time that we'd have as many mouths to feed. This is another part of Marty Up the Creek and the pressure on and the tape recorder that I feel so nervous about. I really have to produce because he said this morning that it's hard even to feed the faculty and their families this year. And, I feel a special burden in that respect. On the dock yesterday, somebody said, "Would you make room for that scout troop?" And I said, So the lady who went up to the end of the lake up here, I can't pronounce the name, said, "What youth group is it?" And I said, "Well, it's a family." So I used to go around giving lectures on population explosion, and some of them at least visibly aren't produced my way. But if this is the case, I suppose what I'm really getting at is that the way I'd like to do this week is formulate some things in your presence, try them out on you, and have you contribute to them, because what I'm now talking about is so unformed and so early in the stage of development in my own mind that I'm not at all sure of myself, and I wouldn't trust anybody who is. kind of topic I'm on this week is not something about which we ought to trust each other. And we're going to talk about things we're right in the middle of. We're going to move from today a little discussion of a cultural analysis, the world around us, to Wednesday, something about the church. I'm never disinterested in talking about the church because this happens to be the form in which the Spirit comes to us for bringing about change in that world. And then Friday, something on the personal dimension. What does each of us do about making sense of this world around us? And the text for our morning meditation is presented here, and we'll use it all week. I thought I'd put it out for you this way because I'll be thinking about this for the next couple of years. Most articles I write and eventually some book will be based on the text. This is how I work. I'm basically a plunderer, a plagiarist, a pirate. I linger until I hear somebody say something that I wish I had said, and then I say it in 250 pages, what they said in 20 lines, and thus support that scout troop. And this is probably the one that is going to bother me a great deal the next couple of years. Let me read it now, and then we'll know what we want to work on. Hannah Arendt, a great social philosopher, in her book Between Past and Future, is discussing the kind of thing that worries or ought to worry men in Dr. Bainton's and my profession. We're historians and we're church historians. We're basically dealing with the past, how we intervene in the present in the light of the past, how we shape the future in the light of the past, and we're doing it at a moment when people have a great deal of difficulty relating to their traditions. We're all in the kind of a throwaway mood right now, or if we want to hang on, we don't know what to hold on to. And her book, Between Past and Future, is a collection of essays on just this kind of problem. And the one that interests me most from the religious angle is her discussion of what has happened in the modern world with the disintegration of a single authority, God, Bible, King. Once upon a time, she's picturing all the people in a certain culture, whether they were good people or bad people, smart or dumb, rich or poor, at least somehow agreed that there was a single authority reference outside. And just as a simple fact of history, she's stating and then assuming that that is not the case today. We don't find it that easy to agree on a particular authority to hold a society together. And if so, what has happened to our society? She writes, authority, resting on a foundation in the past as its unshaken cornerstone, gave the world the permanence and durability which human beings need precisely because they are mortals, the most unstable and futile beings we know of. The loss of authority is tantamount to the loss of the groundwork of the world, this morning's title, which indeed since then has begun to shift, to change and transform itself with ever-increasing rapidity from one shape, should say, into another, as though we were living and struggling with a protean universe where everything at any moment can become almost anything else. Protean comes from the old Greek water god Proteus, who was a prophet and who had the interesting knack of being able to turn himself into any shape. About the time you thought you had him sized up, he turned out to be some other shape. And those two, three lines, I think, describe our culture about as well as anything else. About the time you have our culture described as secular, along come a generation of young people who are hippie and soul and flower children and zen and every kind of religious. About the time you have them sized up, they can turn astonishingly godless on you again. In politics, you can hear one analyst describe ours as a society with increasing conservative tendencies, ever more repressive, and you can look around somewhere else and see whole masses of people in our society who seem to be as rejective of that as ever before. You pick your analyst and you just find that by the time he has it sized up, he has to write an appendix or a revision. And it's interesting to see the revised versions of all the books that were written about 8-10 years ago. Or even more important, the authors who would just as soon not have you remind them of the book they wrote 8-10 years ago. Used to be an author went through his life defending all his earlier works. Nowadays they go around explaining them or helping you forget them. So, like the god Proteus, our culture has this dimension. We want to talk about it. Everything at any moment can become almost anything else. I like to use the picture of a wave that sloshes back and forth from one shore to another all the time. And then on the last days, when we'll come to the other little part of her paragraph and see what it might mean for a Christian to live in this kind of world, but the loss of worldly permanence and reliability, she says, does not entail, at least not necessarily, the loss of the human capacity for building, preserving, and caring for a world that can survive us and remain a place fit to live in for those who come after us. Is this a minimal charter for a Christian too, or are there distinctive things that Christians can bring, are things that I'll try to discuss with you on Friday. When I begin by assuming the kind of change that Dr. Mayton also referred to last night, when I describe our protean culture in which there's such a sudden shifting of shape, I'm not sure I should just assume that we all share that point of view. I can maybe tell a little story to indicate how people like I learn things and how I might learn things today. Last winter, I gave a lecture on conflict and religion at a little college in Green Bay, Wisconsin, St. Norbert's. They have a lectureship where they bring in people from politics and the arts and religion on one theme. That was our theme this year. That evening, the room may seat 600-700 people. And the first rows, 20 deep or so, were all townspeople from Green Bay and DePere and other parts of Wisconsin. A lot of them church people, many of them older people who came because that particular lecture had to do with religion. The student body, as student bodies do, wanting to stay out of range a little bit. McLuhan has his theories about why people sit in back pews of churches. Kind of check me out a little more, and if it gets a little dull, it's a little easier to escape from back there. So the students were arranged a little further back, and this does a funny thing to a lecture. For one thing, it was an arena-type auditorium, which is, again, if you have ever lectured, an absolutely different circumstance than if you're on stage. If you're on a stage and people are down there, they don't ask any questions. Mm-hmm. Or if they do, they're nervous, defensive questions, or belligerent, because they know you've got the mic, and you've got 6 feet on them, and you're just going to overwhelm them, and there they are. Mm-hmm. If you're in an arena, like a medical place, you might as well be stretched out on a table there. Because they can throw tomatoes and questions and so on. It's a good vantage. But if you're nearsighted like I, you look out at the closer range first. And I saw a lot of beautiful silver hair and people from my peer group. I let my sideburns grow, Elmer, this week just so people wouldn't get you and me mixed up. I brought my barber along, and by the end of the week, she'll take care of it. Early in the week, I wanted to establish an identity. Well, I looked at the other gray-haired people, and I suppose I instinctively talked to them or us, and had my little lecture and went my way, and next morning, I had to fly back to Chicago and then to New York without even stopping at home. And 9 in the morning plane from Chicago to New York, the rush hour is past. You have it pretty much to yourself, personal stewardess and all the rest. And on this plane with maybe only 10, 12 people in the tourist section, a beautiful blonde girl came down the aisle and sat next to me, even though there were about 100 other seats around. And this just never happens to people. Gary Grant, yes, Elmer Witten, Martin Martino. So I pretend to keep reading the paper for a while. She said, you're Dr. Marty, aren't you? Well, my fame is spreading. I've made it. Move over, Malcolm and Jim Pike and all the rest. I'm getting recognized. I have to start wearing dark glasses. But how do you happen to know me? I couldn't help asking. Well, I heard you at the DePere last night. Well, how do you like St. Norbert's? I don't go to St. Norbert's. Where are you from? Well, I go to Oshkosh University Extension now. And I said, well, how did you happen to hear me? Well, I came to hear you. And I said, well, what was the great appeal here? Were you interested in the topic? No. How did you get on to me? Well, I'd never heard of you before. what had happened? Well, She was flying to Connecticut for a christening, and on Monday morning, reports on a speech were due, and there were no speeches at Oshkosh Friday night. She looked at the Wisconsin map of colleges and found out that there was a speech at St. Albert's Fair, and she drove over for it, and that's how she happened to hear me. Well, I read the paper again, and breakfast came, but I couldn't resist reading my report card, because if she was there to check me out, how did I do? So, yes, she had it with and wouldn't mind discussing it, and she unrolled a great big chart that the speech teacher at Oshkosh had given them, how you do on various things. It's like this thing in our yellow deal today. Do you have cold and diarrhea, or talk to God and all that? How was I doing on these things? Well, I was really impressed with myself, except on one point: makes unsubstantiated generalizations. She had a big check there. And I thought, this is it. I'm a historian, and we use footnotes, and you document things, and you're pretty sure of things, and I just don't make unsubstantiated generalizations. So I said, name one. What did I do? She said, well, at the beginning of your speech, you said, as everyone in this room knows, this nation has never been so divided since the Civil War as it is now. Black against white, men against women, old against young, rich against poor, left against right, and so on. And she said, maybe the people in the first 10, 20 rows knew that. Some of them might have been around since the Civil War. But she said, we didn't. Those of us in college don't. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, I have never lived in a world that hasn't been deeply, hopelessly divided across generations and black and white and so on. Well, I started telling her about the long ago, Martin Luther King and integration, and John Kennedy and Peace Corps symbols, and 1950s, the Eisenhower era. Nelson Algren says, melted like cotton candy in the mouth of history. The era of good feelings, when everybody was full of positive thinking and peace of mind and peace of soul and so on. That was not her world. She's in college. And she said, we grew up in a world that is only conflict. My wife and I were with the Army, all the Marty boys, at Holy Name Seminary in Madison, Wisconsin this year for a meeting of Catholic minor seminarians from around the country. That means high school and first 2 years of college. In the evening, they had a rock mass show, combined some liturgical elements with some dramatic elements, kind of a reworking of the Job story. It was interesting to us that throughout it, they kept talking about the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. And after a while, over Cokes, I said, I'll tell you, funny, you know, one of the Trinity's missing. What about JFK? Well, that's too long ago. We don't really, we remember that he died, but we don't remember his presidency. We don't remember what he stood for, the trauma of the day. You know, after all, we're only in college. We were sixth and seventh graders then. Well, I think there are some dividing lines in our history, and I imagine that someday we're going to find that this may well have been somewhere. We thought the world was being put together a certain way. Around 1960, there was quite a turn in the way we were looking at things. Joffrey Barraclough has written a book called Toward an Understanding of Contemporary History, or something like this, in which he lined up all of the pins. These were the years when we were becoming conscious of words like cybernetics. What minister could have used the word automation in 1955? By 1960 he could. After Sputnik, 1958, mass higher education became our assumption. Before that, you just didn't expect that the majority of the young people of our culture would go to college. After that, it begins to shift. The assumptions change. Mass higher education. Third world. He had pointed to a speech by Adlai Stevenson noticing the year in which the UN suddenly woke up to the fact that the voting power had shifted away from the big old powers to the 100 nations around them. He lined all of these things up, and from this we drew certain conclusions about the direction the culture was going to take. Kind of a strange mixture of Kennedy idealism, pragmatism. kind of an inspired spiritual vision of Martin Luther King's nonviolence, a kind of an ecumenical interfaith spirit for which Pope John was a symbol. And somewhere around 63, 4, 5, what is it? Beginning with the Kennedy assassination and the burning of Watts and the death of Pope John and the end of the Vatican Council. These are a few of the little symbols that show to us a very dramatic and sudden change. And a lot of people in this room have begun to have their developmental or adult experience only after that. So, when I want to talk today about the suddenness of this cultural shift, or the ability of people in the same culture to see the same things and give precisely opposite interpretations to them, I'm comparing this to a world of the 40s. We all agreed on how to fight that war. Even the Korean War, wasn't a lot of internal debate. Or the years of the beginning of the civil rights movement, when we least all knew what we ought to do. It was the problem of the will, not of the knowledge. All we had ahead of us. I look back to those years as, strange to say, relatively stable but last phases of an old culture, of an old worldview. A lot of the books of theology, some of which many of you may have read in the 1960s, I think were fashioned out of that last possible moment to look at the world as a serene, rational, programmable place. That's what I see to be falling apart now. Now, I may be making unsubstantiated generalizations. Maybe in 1958 the world would have looked to me the same way, but I don't think it did, and I don't meet anybody it did, and I'll be glad to hear some intergenerational discussion of this to find out whether I'm dealing with a fictional moment, whether there is this kind of change. I think I got onto this a couple of years ago, a year and a half and a few days ago, February 4th, 1968, to be precise, when I was assigned to be one of two lecturers on the subject of the generation gap, a word I use and despise. The Thomas More Society has an annual lectureship, and every year one man can do it, but not when it came to the generation gap, because it was assumed that no one could speak for both sides of it. So they phoned me, and would I take on one of the lectures? And I said, yeah, you caught me at the last possible moment, because that's the eve, February 4th, of my 40th birthday. And I will be 10 years over the hill, or 14, however you measure, or what. So I wouldn't be really plausible spokesman any longer for the younger generation. And Dan Hurst said, we did look at your biography before we invited you, and we do know it's the day before your 40th birthday. And we didn't want to take you a day later because we thought a day later you wouldn't be plausible any longer as a spokesman for the older generation. Because we want to attract kids, and our other spokesman is going to be Jim Forrest, who's 26, also pushing the upper limits, of the Catholic Peace Fellowship. So I thought, well, that's a challenge. I have to be old young or young old and study the generation gap for the first time. The more I read about it, the more I decided that we weren't really talking about generation gap in the sense that most people mean it. As if, and I don't mind tomatoes being pelted here, I'm not trying to win any popularity contest, as if a sudden superior breed of people have come upon the scene. I believe in vitamins and genes and DNA and big people creating big people, and I'm starting to see my sons pass me up, and I know all that stuff, but I don't think IQs have risen that much in a few years, and I don't think that the moral standard of the world has risen that much in a few years. So I ask myself, what is different? Because there is, I will defend the point, that there's something very different going on. Marc Bloch, a French historian, is defined a generation as a group of people who have a certain set of decisive experiences in their developmental years. Nothing ever hits you quite as hard as it hits you when you're going into teens and through them and out. This is when you're forming your world, your worldview, separating from parents, or had better be. You're picking up signals around you. You're trying to figure out vocation, truth and falsehood, mate. It all crashes in on you in a few years. And if you go through a certain set of experiences surrounded by certain other things, you're going to turn out a different way. In this sense, I agree with Karl Marx in a way that man is his culture. Man is shaped very much by what goes on. When you were talking before about the kids' peer group, you were giving us one more illustration that if your child were growing up in a ghetto, he'd be part of a different decisive experience than he is in a subdivision in a suburban high school. But all of them have been going through their need to form a worldview in the years that I'm describing, in the midst of the assassinations, after the belief that nonviolence was going to bring about change, after the high idealism of early Peace Corps. I'm not saying all these things have disintegrated, but they don't have the field to themselves now. And it's this, I think, that has led us to look at the people who are coming up. What are they able to pick up? Now, after you start on that basis, you find that the one secret that the young know about the old is that the old people are also going through this set of experiences, but they're going through them at a time when it's harder to relate positively and openly to them. I began that speech with a kind of a put-on. I described a generation, relatively affluent, quite leisured, not believing in the way the establishment runs things, often pictured as being Epicurean and hedonistic, sauna baths and jacuzzi pools and all those things, having the problem of boredom. I went through the whole thing and hoped the whole audience would have a syndrome in which they're picturing somebody 18 years old, and I said, I've just described the 75 to 80 year olds of our society as you'll meet them in retirement villages, and played from there into other ways in which you can see that people who don't have to run things right now are more free to make changes. He's over my right shoulder here, but I don't think he blushes easily. As I was listening to Dr. Bainton last night, I kept thinking, I imagine that if I would poll most of the young people who were in that room last night, they would say that spiritually he belongs to their generation, probably more likely than Witt and I do. He's free. He's retired. He doesn't have to worry about academic tenure. he can start saying what he really believes. He has nothing, you know, nothing to lose. I've been in the study of a lot of Catholic religious orders, and they'll get in people from the middle generation like me to listen. And we're the only people that listen to the novices. This is the few girls who want to be nuns or boys who want to be monks or religious or whatever you want to call it, from 14 to 25 years old or so. What's interesting is they let us alone with them for 4 or 5 hours. We take no notes. There are no tape recorders. We don't learn their names because there's not supposed to be any transfer of what any individual has said to the older people. But we're supposed to listen. Ask them anything you want. And they've never been asked before. They're in systems where you have counselors and absolvers and novice masters haunting them 18 hours a day, and they have the feeling that nobody ever interviewed them till that morning. All right, we'll run out a whole program of what they think ought to be going on in the church and in their order. And then in the evening, we'll report back on what we heard. And I still remember with the Viatorians, old Father McCracken, I used to run into him making hospital sick calls. 88 years old. Tough as they come. To get up, and I thought, boy, here goes. You know, why did we even bother to report? He completely agreed with the novices. It's the provincial general and the novice master who were nervous. All right. What I'm trying to say here is it isn't just what year you're born, but how free you are to relate to some kinds of experiences, how free you are to make some change along the way, how heavy your investment is in the way things are. During the WIT session this morning, we were talking about how few young people can point to any happy marriages. And we say maybe they get this from seeing the movie The Graduate or looking at their parents or something like that. But I didn't want to talk too much during which thing. I talked too much anyhow. But I kept thinking, how many of us look around the circle of acquaintances we have in business or at cocktail parties and really can point to a lot of people who we think have a really happy marriage? We have some. And that's enough to help every one of us keep going. But I don't think if we're really honest, we would point out the people we know to our own kids and say, have a marriage like that one. Imitate them. All right, this is what the old and the young are smoking out and smelling. And so we really do have all the same things in common. We're just relating to them in different ways. My formula for 1968, some people say our darkest and most confused political year. Even Ted White can't make sense of it. He invents sense out of nonsense sometimes, but he can't even make sense of it. Or 1969. I have a little formula. I just say the old explanations no longer explain, and the old forms no longer sustain. Just think about that for a little while. The old explanations no longer explain. We keep asserting them. We keep saying this is how it ought to be. Somebody said before, and I agree with her, many parishes will say, we'd like to have a good adult education program. I doubt if any of you are from a Lutheran church in here where the leadership hasn't said this. Do any of you believe it? I read John Fry a few years ago on a hard look at adult Christian education. These people aren't accidentally ignorant of the Bible, they're willfully ignorant of the Bible. They're not staying away from adult past merely because they're sometimes boring. They're staying away from it because there's a lot of dynamite there that might ask us to change our way. And a church that gets an effective adult education program going is going to be in trouble because it can't stay where it was. And so if you're really smart, just have a good, strong Sunday school. They're easy to run. Vacation Bible schools. Our parish, we had a great assistant last year, great Sunday school superintendent. They had a simple little idea, kind of a Holden idea. We'll have our vacation Bible school by families. And he lined up all kinds of speakers. The first time in 6 years the parish ever asked me to do something, he's busy, don't touch it. Since I'm a lot of other places, I don't let him know that I'm not all that busy. But would I come out and talk to the teens? He had the great Lutheran theologian Anson Mount, who is Hugh Hefner's right-hand man at Playboy. He had the head of the Chicago Crime Commission. Now, five stellar attractions for the teenagers, and a similar thing for the adults. Well, we aren't a huge parish. We usually have about 150 children in Vacation Bible School when you hold it in the morning. And I think he had eight. There were no teenagers. I was the first speaker. The adults were his wife and the pastor's wife and the Sunday school student's wife and so on. What did we learn in one evening? They knew this, by the way. It was to be a little lesson to us. Vacation Bible School is babysitting. It's a good way for mothers in summer to have three free hours, and only those eight that got victimized by the pastor to run it. Right. So, if you could just pay eight people to run a Bible school, your parish can lapse back into happy complacency and nothing will be changed. But get eight adults to come to something and it starts changing them. And you don't want that change. Okay. So, it isn't that we don't know there's these things going on, it's that we don't want to make the changes that go along with them. In the time around now this morning, this is all to set you up for what I want to do all week. I want to move away from church and personal reminiscence and all that into a discussion of a few dimensions of what I think go on at the time when worldviews are changing. If you buy provisionally with me, and you don't have to, Hannah Arendt's picture that the culture is without an authority and sloshing back and forth, then you'll bracket for a moment the attempt to say we have a new worldview formed. And I do this. I do it willfully. I do it against the grain. I'll do it even if my books won't sell thereby. I'll write nasty little articles about faddism, but I simply won't salute everybody that rings up a flag and says, here is the worldview that we all now have come into. I don't think we are at that stage. I call this between worldviews. You get a breathless sense in every new book that this guy has it nailed down. A few years ago, it was McLuhan's worldview. This is the only thing that was going to determine the future. I've been strongly influenced by McLuhan. I intend to keep on being. I want to be open to all these things, and I think that there's an awful lot right about him. He doesn't want to be judged that way. I've heard him caught in contradiction say, "I neither agree nor disagree with anything I've just said." So it isn't, is McLuhan right or wrong? I don't even want to get into that debate. But is he opening me up to some things I hadn't been open to before? But his worldview, I think, is probably as obsolete as Copernicus is already. A lot of things have outlived it and served as counterforces to it. So the next year we were all told, I'm going to run this through some M's. It doesn't end with Marty, by the way. After McLuhan, 2 years ago, it was the Maharishi. Remember, Life magazine had the year of the Maharishi. You couldn't get on late night TV without hearing out. You should, you know, go to the guru of your choice. And we were all going to turn Eastern and only Eastern. We were going to drop all Western modes of doing anything. And just as the Playboy people told me when they put out their God is Dead issue, damn it, we were 8 months late and God's alive again. Life was on a weekly schedule. Isn't life weekly? And by the time, you program faster with the weekly, I know. By the time it was the year of the Maharishi was pretty well exposed as a second-rate phony guru and beating back the bushes and not drawing crowds, and his book was being remaindered, and people were off another direction. So that worldview didn't stick. And this year, or last year, I suppose, it's Marcuse. I got to keep these M's going. Herbert Marcuse. Again, I tend to keep learning as much from him as I do about East from the Maharishis. I think Marcuse has some insights into elements of our culture that weren't around before. For those of you who haven't had to keep up with all this yet, he's the popular prophet of the revolution, who is among those who believes you can combine Freud and Marx. In other words, have a revolution and a good time too. Who has spotted that America is not necessarily going to produce a proletariat, what Marxist revolutions have always needed. Our laboring classes, our blue collars, aren't going to be revolutionaries. They're fighting for their color TV and better union contracts. At our university this year, we had a riot, and one of the demands was that next year half of the student body come from families with less than $7,000 a year income, so that we would have a proletariat, so the campus would have more radicals. Well, if you'd get whites under 7,000 a year, you'd have Wallace voters, children, and that's it. You'd have a proletariat that way. Well, Marcuse knows this, and he is saying the movement for revolution has to come from elsewhere, students and intellectuals and so on. Marcuse has, again, a lot to contribute, but I resist the impulse to go along and say, now we have that worldview formed that is the style, the lifestyle for all people coming along. Rather, I see in this procession of contradictory forces, McLuhan and Marcuse are really opposites, and yet a lot of people are picking them both up at the same time. McLuhan is almost saying whatever is right if it comes through the media. You forget your old canons of good and bad and taste. The message itself is what matters. Marcuse is saying the media as we have them are enslaving. They trivialize people. They buy off discontent. They keep ghetto people from revolting because they have one instrument of the affluent society, a TV set, and this gives them all they need because they get the impression that they're part of it. Well, these are opposites, but they're building stones. They're contributors to what we are going to have to work with if we want to fashion some way of relating to a world around us. What is a worldview? I'm going to pause here just a moment and have you throw in some things. What do we mean when we say people have a worldview? Coming all the way from Chicago, I suppose I should have said Weltanschauung, because that sounds a little more as if you ought to import somebody to say that. But a worldview. I'll toss out a few things that come to my mind when I talk about a worldview. My favorite phrase for it is your mentally furnished apartment. We all live in mentally furnished apartments. We do not completely fashion our own world. Our world is given. If you want to make sense, you use language. Language is a given. Every word has a history. It's shaped by needs that people have. Our perceived world is a given. Who says the things we do are good manners and other things are bad manners? Why do men walk, or did men walk, along the curb and the women further in? Avoid the gutter splashing, the women wouldn't get manure all over them when the horses would come sloshing by. Or why do we take off our hat, or why do we shake hands, disarm ourselves, and so on? These all have a history. They are part of what we now say make up a cultured person. They're givens to us. Most of us don't know why. If you ever studied the things that go with marriage, whether in church or out, this is part of a given world. Last night we were discussing Mexican ceremonies and how they put their little idol on the back of the altar. We look at that just as we look at it. They're half pagan and half Christian. Well, look at the Christian marriage ritual. If you don't tamper with it, it's basically a pagan ceremony that we put a few words on, tied us over the weekend with a few words about God. But basically, it's a pagan ceremony, and most of the rituals there. It's a given world, and yet try to violate it. Let a couple write a Christian ceremony and purge the other elements, and their pure group will run them out on a rail. It's a given world, right? We move into this given world. We have a lot of social conventions. We say reverend, we say doctor, we say father. We build little facades, and in a way these are necessary. Well, they're absolutely necessary. As long as we take them with a little humor, as long as we learn to pierce them and see through them, as long as we know that the world is a stage, anyhow, they're given. Now, in a mentally furnished apartment, you don't all live the same way. You can have different lifestyles in similar apartments. You can rearrange the furniture. You can put up new wallpaper. You can brighten it. You can dim it. You can let rodents come into it. You can do all that. But an awful lot of our world is simply given. So I'm talking about our recognized, perceived world before we start doing things with it. And then not just your own, but so widespread that we can trade on each other's. We can go and, we can communicate with each other. We recognize each other's. So widespread as to be virtually universal. Something that's not necessarily consciously acquired. We're not sitting down in 1969 and saying, let's get a new worldview. We're not going to get an absolutely new worldview. You'd have to throw away every word, every memory, every trace of your old culture. It isn't going to happen. You may transform and transvalue them. But unconsciously, you find yourself moving into a new mentally furnished apartment. Ordinarily, I think a worldview has some mythic and symbolic and religious dimensions. You don't know it while you're inside one. You ever notice when you live in a certain place, you think that's what all the world looks like? I always find that when I read novels, when people move from one room to another, and if it doesn't relate to my house or a house that I know, I get disoriented and I have to draw a new diagram and find out how they're living there. You don't realize that this is a given world. Remember a couple of years ago, Time magazine did a covered story on Bishop Pike and how he was seeing the world purged of myth. A year or two later, he was back in the myth business. But that year, the world was being purged of myth. And what was interesting to me was, it was a very bad article because they had wanted to say nice things about him and they ended up finding nobody to say nice things about him that year. So they had to rescue it. And they went to John Donne, a very gifted young priest theologian at Notre Dame, who said that he thought that Pike's intention was basically misguided because the world isn't going to live without myth. What you do is move into a new worldview and feel that all previous ones were mythic. We have no trouble seeing the myth of pre-Copernicus, a Ptolemaic worldview, stupid people that thought the world was the center and poked holes in for the stars and the sun and the moon. Oh, those dummies. They had sun gods and all the rest, and then we moved beyond this. We have no myth. The minute you move past a worldview, you see the mythic character of the earlier one, and you always believe that yours is the one that's post-mythic. I think there is a mythic dimension to them. And I imagine that if we're now in a Darwinian, Freudian, Marxian kind of worldview, we see all of the myths as late as the Enlightenment and the Renaissance and all those. But we don't see how mythic our own is until we see people come along who are post-Freudian and post-Marxist and post-Darwinian, whatever either of these things mean, and they show people made a kind of a religion of these things. Now we have to get out of that. Find out what our new post-mythic one is. So I'm saying there's a kind of a religious or mythic or symbolic dimension to it. Well, these are the things I mean by worldview. Can we toss a couple more things into the hopper that any of you might mean by a worldview? If you want to talk about being between them. Don't need formal definitions. Colorful ones are better than precise ones.
Martin, you tossed us something passed over quickly, but mm-hmm. caught me a little bit. You said that we need the facades. Why do we need them?
I suppose I would argue we need them for the same reason that you need a cuticle on your physical body. If you didn't have it, if all your nerve endings were exposed to every heat, every cold, if you had to organize every impression from scratch, I think you'd be literally insane in almost no time at all. So a cuticle is a beautiful thing. A callus isn't, because the callus keeps you from getting those necessary impressions, heat and cold and sensitive touch and so on. Now, in human relations, I would compare it to that. I would say, less biological, more philosophical. Alfred North Whitehead divides life into routine and understanding, and says if you really want to be free for understanding, for depth perception when necessary, then you have to relegate certain things to routine. If you had to think this morning about how to tie a shoe, if you had to relearn shoe tying every day, your day wouldn't get started. We are greatly aided by certain kinds of habit and custom and routine. The crucial thing is to know when to apply understanding to routine and ask, is what we're doing right? The prophet is the man who always brings understanding to routine and says these facades are not all right. So, let me apply it to the religious realm. I think Peter Berger did this beautifully in his book some years ago, Noise of Solemn Assemblies. He says, the academic world is the world that thought it lived without myth. Remember, we're in the critical analytic business. I think it's called here cultural analysis. And we're the post-mythical types. Did you ever watch an academic procession? And so what does the faculty do? Well, it's nervous about it, so you sort of joke about it. You pretend. I remember when I got my PhD, I didn't even, a hood cost $9. And I was never going to wear a hood again, so I didn't buy one. And a few years later, you start getting invited to give this or that lectureship, and it says, bring your academic garb. Finally, I bought one, and now I start getting honoraries, and someday I'll probably have a wall full of plumage like that. And so you make fun of it. It doesn't mean it's like that. You intentionally hope that moths will eat a little bit at it. Oxford style, they wear them until the last little dribble is on the sleeve, and B.O. 8 feet away, but it symbolizes something to them. They're working. All right, in religion, we could say facade, those beautiful things those guys wore last night in serving the bread and wine to us. Could do without them. Sometimes we should, and we'd better. A few times a year, at least, we better just have communion in somebody's basement or some way to know that the upper or lower rooms or what are involved here. There's a sense in which you belong to the church also by seeing reminiscence of a communion of saints that transcends just our present dirty t-shirts and so on. Now, Peter Berger carries this over and says, but now let's think. Let's notice there's a humorous side to it. He says, when you think of a suburban minister putting a white plastic-looking disc between the lipstick lips of a wide-brimmed, hatted, affluent suburban matron in the name of a dying Jewish god, they're better, sometime or other, he better, this is a very funny thing. Very funny thing you're doing. Bread. That's not bread. That's a squeeze. I was a little disappointed that Holden used it. I thought here they would really take a piece of bread and jam it at me, and maybe they often do. I'm too new to criticize, but I might leave some bread behind for the next minute. Here we ought to be free from those things. And yet, maybe it's good that we tie in a little bit with what goes on in home parish until we change home parish, so that we're not just a new snobby elite that's got everything fixed right away. That's what I mean by the fact that if you smile at a facade, if you know you're living in it, then you realize that it is also liberating. Does this make sense?
Yes.
What the critics of our society, the restless, the blacks, the gifted, the young, are seeing is that we become a society of facades. Nothing behind it. Routine and not understanding. Keep the form, but not know why you did it. And I think this is why in their approach to religious life, so much of what we do is only the facade that keeps the conventions going to prevent people from staring at reality. But I don't think that they will get away from the development of their own facade. I'm part of what's called underground church, and I like to be a critic from within of anything I'm a part, and so I do twitty little things about how established it gets in a little while. You have an underground church, and within a year you have to have a newsletter for it. And that's the beginning of the denominational press. They're just little things that come up. If you want to be free for what matters, I suppose what I would say about the facade is what a teacher of mine once said about certain stuff. He said, take it very, 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 very seriously, but not too seriously. Or in terms of our come, take it not ultimately, but penultimately. An awful lot of things that we think are the ultimates are really the penultimate. But worldview, slap in a few more things. I have four quick illustrations then to finish.
Do you feel that the young and this so-called generation gap are making any attempt to bridge it, or are they simply building it?
I think there's much variety among them as there are among 40-year-olds and 80-year-olds, and so I'm very cautious about generalizing there. I think there are great hungers among most people for some sort of communion with other people. I think that when she spoke before of her child in the peer group, you can see that there are forces that want to prevent people from having communion across certain lines. We have vested interest in not such sharing. But look, with the young, who've been their heroes in the 20th century? With few exceptions, very old people. You know, the most radical young Catholic room, and whose picture does he still have on the wall? Pope John. Protestants, Schweitzer, Tilly, Gandhi, old, wizened sages. This must say something. Now they have pop heroes too. We all do. We don't. You know, you can't be all that serious all the time. No reason you have to reach for the nearly ultimate all the time. But I think these are symbols of this kind of communion. And if you look at the campus celebrities, they aren't only the young Ginsburgs. I saw Paul Tillich one time at Berkeley in front of 6,000 students about the year of the free speech revolt. They were there for him and he for them. You have to be young reciprocally. And I think there is, but it takes a special breed of young to be the pioneers to bridge it. If they capitulate too early and too easily, we don't get the message. This is what's happened in the black movement. I'm willing to tell you a lot more about that than I. But we always wonder, why don't they simply turn pleasant again? You know, they used to say yes and no. They used to shuffle around a little bit. Why are they so goddamn arrogant? Well, if they capitulate easily, there's a loss of an identity, because it's to the advantage of 9/10 of the society to keep blacks from having an identity. It's the advantage of an awful lot of us in society to keep young from having an identity. Beautiful thing for them to get. I think there's a quest for that knowing. But it dare not be bought cheaply. That's the same thing to me. Some people do anything to get an identity. They'll throw it away. Are we far enough into worldview that I can give my four quick illustrations? Because time is about up. What happens when, as we have in Hannah Arendt's terms, the loss of the groundwork? I'll just comment very briefly. First of these is loss of the old authority. I've assumed this all morning. In politics, it's been coming for centuries. The king is dead. For many people in Western Europe, meant God is dead. The divine right of kings, when that was breached, it took a long time for people to find alternatives. In the United States, we found fairly easily and fairly early an alternative in giving the people the divine right. But we're less sure of that today. Miss Arendt says that political authority changed from the day when you no longer had fear of hell associated with it. When Pope and Emperor, priest and politician, were in union, you had a certain kind of agreed upon authority. In the Middle Ages, the people were afraid that their king, they would be put under the interdict. They couldn't have the sacraments, they couldn't be saved, or so on. The absence of the fear of hell meant a change. And she's chronicling this, but it means the political order. In religion, I'll do this more, a good deal more on Wednesday, the simply agreed upon book, or that you all thought you knew what you meant when you said God. In education, reference to an authority was supposed to carry the day. We see this breakup of the old authority. In our political order, I think this is very clear right now. It's interesting to me that whenever I talk to friends in the SDS, they are all convinced that they will prevail. I personally don't think they have a ghost of a chance of prevailing on their present terms, because I think the other side has the guns. I think they can mess up some things, they can keep us off balance, but in the simple terms of what they think they're after, I think they have an absolutely wrong picture of how things are going. On the other hand, whenever I talk to my Cicero friends who are Wallaceites, they really think they're going to prevail in their terms. They just might. I'm a little more nervous about them prevailing. But I think it would be a temporary prevalence because it would bottle up so many kinds of forces that are not acceptable to too many other forces in the society. So we're living in a society in which there's not an agreed upon authority. We finally elect a president. Toss your coin, who was it? I always pretend not to know, and the world is the same. Not know. I haven't extended diplomatic recognition yet. I haven't used the name. But it wouldn't have been much different the other way around. Finally somebody gets 50.001% of the votes and we say that the people have spoken. But we don't pretend that really speaks for, a near majority of the people form blocks that simply aren't represented by them. So the political order doesn't represent a single kind of authority to it. Talk about Hannah Arendt's protean world. Read Peter Schrag's article in the New Harper's on the lower middle classes. Very important, very good article. In the last couple lines, after he's visited the Gary, Indiana's and so on, says, here are hundreds of thousands of Americans who in the spring of a year were ready to vote for Bobby Kennedy and in the fall of the year voted for George Wallace. Anyone who can turn from a liberal Democrat hero to someone pictured as a racial bigot demagogue hero within a couple of months is somebody we better begin to understand. Well, we're in that kind of a society. To me, that just spells out further documentation that we don't have an agreed upon sense of authority right now. Do we learn to live with it? Do we just say this is how society is always going to be? Do we look for new consensus? How cheaply do we find it? That's the one. The loss of the groundwork of authority. I'm simply borrowing her term. Second, I put down the confusion over experts. This, I think, is something happens at a time when an old worldview is falling apart. Graham Huff has written an essay on to whom we turn to find out about the world. In earlier cultures, it was the literary man, the literate person. And he would know, he would tell us. The priest, the clerk, the cleric, the intellectual. And he said, in the modern world, we turn to science for this. I think by the time the ink was dry on his essay, we were again beginning to turn a little bit. Science was getting more self-critical and communicating this to the public. But the public is then very much confused. A doctor who was one of my parishioners had osteomyelitis, and they did some sort of an operation, and for 6 weeks it was in a cast. And I said, well, what it'll be like when it's done? He hadn't the faintest idea. He said, well, you mean you subject yourself to all this? And, yeah. I said, you might as well scrape around on me as well as anybody else. It'd be nice if it would work. I said, well, you're in medicine. Things are supposed to work. And he says, well, I think the better doctor you have, the more likely you'll say is we're just a little bit up above the witch doctor. Most of the things that really are good, we don't know too much about yet. And if only we could convey to the public that when they say, you know, my doctor says, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's final truth. Well, doctors, I guess, are making enough mistakes in the modern world that people are learning this. It isn't always that. And you go to two doctors and get different diagnoses. ABM. It was interesting to me that virtually every scientist employed by the military was sure the ABM would work, and had endless documentation for it, and an equal number, virtually everyone not employed by the military, was sure it wouldn't work and had equal impressive documentation. Sooner or later, it's going to come to the public that science doesn't know all these things. So, we turn back to the literary figure. We turn to the artists. We turn to them to give us certain truths about society. The point is, instead of simply accepting a caste as having authority, the priest or the scientist, persons in them have to win their credentials. You either have charisma or convey things a certain way, or you have a great breakthrough or something like that. But it's going to mean that for the immediate future, people are going to be in a shopping mood. They're going to buy their own favorite scientists or their own favorite artists without necessarily coming to agree with each other. The third, and which we're talking about this in family life today, the disintegration of models. In a worldview, you operate with certain models. We called them facades before. These are falling apart. The two-party system. How much faith do we have in its present form? Denominationalism. Do you think how absurd denominationalism is? Because the real important differences in the church today are within every denomination, not between them. I can get you 40 of my best friends, and they'll be Episcopal, Catholic, every breed of Lutheran, Presbyterian, Reformed, and so on. And they will be in a very deep spiritual, theological communion with each other, utterly despised by people in their own group and utterly out of contact with them. They can't go back and well, we'll try to put it together. Now, you're not going to have new denominations growing out of this. I'm not predicting schisms. We simply have a form that no longer serves as a model. In the last 100 years, there hasn't been a good theological defense of denominationalism. But it's given. It's there. It's part of our old worldview. Free enterprise. This morning, Rich, we're talking about the girls at Holden talking about what boys expect of them when they can invest back home. Car, hamburgers, dinner out, movie, dance, and so pay off. And at Holden, you know, he's just got to invest in them, so we're kind of free of all that. And I said to Brother Hurstfield, yep, one more proof the capitalistic system is what's leading us to immorality. we don't really believe in all of its forms. We believe in that part of it, which is a payoff for us, but it's not a model that is working for us anymore. We assert it, but we don't believe it. The old math, this is taught in one along the way, is a model that doesn't work for the new things people have to do. The old models, marriage, family, child development, we can see are very much in question right now. And we might, as Christians, or as advocates of a certain element of the culture, hold together our bit of it. And I know beautiful examples of it, and have cited some today. Yet we don't have a model that is easily transferable or believed in by many people in culture. Racial relations, integration, Black power. These are accepted by segments, but not by enough people to say our culture coheres around them. In a very important book that's quoted by almost anybody who does things like I do, T.S. Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolution, KUHN, talks about what happens when the old models fall apart. This is what's happening in higher academia right now, and that's why people in my business are so nervous. What do? When you have an agreed-upon worldview, you have little boxes into which you put things. There's a way to do it. You know what questions to ask, what answers to get. You know what a PhD thesis is for, and what it has to look like. And boy, if anybody deviates a little bit, he isn't going to make it. And this is, how else can you kill people's imagination than by having them write a 600-page dissertation that no one will ever read? They just might turn out to be better than you if you let them find some other form. So you have a model and a mold and the thing into which you push them so that you can kill them off and hold on. They can't mature until you're near retirement. And then the sciences come into the same thing. And then people come along and question them. The young Turks, we call them. And they're going to make a lot of mistakes along the way. But as long as a model, a paradigm, Kuhn says, serves to explain all the facts that need explaining, it's unchallengeable. When it no longer explains, borrowed time is going to die. And I think we're in a stage where an awful lot of these things are on borrowed time. Establishment will fight back harder than ever, but without really believing in it. Those attacking establishment will make a lot of mistakes along the way. They won't always be beautiful alternative models. But we simply find that the old boxes don't quite hold anymore. And meanwhile, we have this Protean world in which everything can shift from one to another. Wisconsin students can look more radical than anything else, and a year later, for all you know, the state legislature can impose a repressive system on them in which some smart students will come along and adapt to that system. We'll all lean back and say we've solved something because we put them back in the box. We haven't solved things. We haven't made people more interpersonal, haven't gotten rid of the bad. You simply borrowed time. We don't believe in the way we were doing it. And finally, uncertainty over myth and symbol. I'll do this in more detail on Wednesday. But what I was referring to with John Donne before, we live in our own myth, our own symbol, but we don't find that these have the same evocative power. Why don't our kids buy the same heroes? Why does blue-collar America today have to plaster a flag on every car? Because they feel they're not buying the values of that flag. Well, the young would buy that flag, and the radicals would buy that flag if they believed that it was a symbol of what it was intended to be a symbol of. But when you see George Wallace and a flag on both sides of it on the back of a car, you just know something is happening to this symbol that is called into question. And so in the religious realm, they look at what goes on in most of our parishes. And they, you know, this is agape. You learned all the words. That's the trouble with the whole day. Teach them all those words. Agape, koinonia. They know they get more koinonia Saturday night than Sunday morning anywhere. And so that symbol itself is then called into question. And I think what I was making fun of before, the Maharishi, is perhaps the best illustration in religion. At a party last year, we were honoring a man who honors our divinity school with funds and is also literate, and so we were each to bring a book for his 70th birthday, our own most recent book. And Elsa, who probably isn't here so I can talk about her, but I could even if she were, who isn't really impressed by the world of theology any more than people ought to be, I suppose, wasn't too interested in most of the books that were lying around the room. But there was a book called From Primitives to Zen by Mircea Eliade, my colleague who studies world religions. And she was looking at the bio sketch. And he's an interpreter of dreams, and he wrote a dissertation 40 years ago under Dasgupta on yoga, and I nearly lost her that night. You know, there they were on the lotus and the plow, and go to the sauna bath, she'll show you. Got into a long discussion then of why Zen, why yoga. For her, it's nothing more than suburban housewife kicks down the Y, I hope. Then Eliade said, yes, but don't make a cult of this. He said, I studied under Dasgupta, who was the world's best. And after 6 years, he said, I've taught you what I can teach you. You have a head knowledge. You know some of the mechanics. Go back to your world, Romania, France, U.S. You can't be a yoga. To be a real yogi, your ancestors should have eaten rice for 1,000 years, and you shouldn't smoke. In other words, you're built into a worldview and a way of life in which you simply can't do it all. You can learn from it, but now he says, transform your own experiences. And then a thought occurred to me that night. How do we go through this whole youth revolution and hippie revolution without them picking up spiritual resources from the West? A little bit of Thoreau. Who else? There was no boom in Jacobemi and Meister Eckhart and Ignatius of Loyola, our mystics and so on. They went shopping somewhere else. Why? Not because I believe they're going to be able to import East into West so easily. They're not going to overcome. But because the symbolic framework in which these have come to us don't any longer carry the meaning. So they have to shop as far from home as possible to bring any kind of light to what we now have. So, breakdown of old authority, breakdown of, so long ago I forgot already, the expert, the model, and the myth are what I want to carry over Wednesday in the religious realm. I really have filibustered. I don't know if we get any chance to visit now, or people have to get gangrene set in somewhere around now, I suppose. While Bainton is at the river, I will be various places this week, and I do enjoy talking about what you like to talk about wherever we are. And we do get some forums, and I promise Wednesday not to do so much of the talking as I do today.